From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill worked through the night last night debating amendments to the American Health Care Act, the Republican plan to replace the Affordable Care Act. We're going to hear from two congressmen now, both Republicans, both from Alabama, but with different takes on it. First, Congressman Bradley Byrne. Congressman, welcome back.
It's great to be back on the show.
And are you still supporting the American Health Care Act?
I am indeed. I know we've got some changes that we'll be going through over the next several days as we get some, you know, reasonable things worked out in it. But yes, in the whole, I support it, and I think we're going to pass it here in the House.
Well, what changes do you think are going to be coming?
Well, there's a pretty active discussion going on right now about the duration of the extension of the Medicaid program. You know, the original plan was for it to be extended 3 years. But I think it may be rolled back from the 3 years to something short of that. Exactly what that'll be, I don't know yet.
But a shorter period of time. So it would actually roll back the expansion of Medicaid even sooner than what was being planned in this plan.
That's right, because there were a number of people that were concerned, and I'll be honest with you, I'm one of them, that we were being too generous in that regard. So, and I come from a state that, you know, did not accept the Medicaid expansion. So people from those states have been arguing that we thought it was more prudent for us to cut back on that.
Are you worried, though, that if you do that, that poor people in this country are going to be unable to get health insurance?
No, I'm not, because what we've done with Obamacare is we put so many mandates on the program, and we've done so many things to make it unattractive for those people to be able to get a doctor, that even though they may have health insurance or have Medicaid, they're not being able to find doctors who will actually treat them. I actually heard that in my town hall meeting Monday night. And we've heard for the last several months that there are people in my district who have Medicaid, but more and more doctors are refusing to accept Medicaid patients. What we're doing with this law will get health care quicker and better to the people in my district who are poor and have the means of being able to get health care through Medicaid or through some sort of an insurance program.
But how are they going to be able to find a doctor if they don't have insurance? If the rollback of the expansion goes even quicker?
Because the doctors out there will find it more attractive to treat these people because they won't have all the heavy mandates and restrictions on the program. I have a lot of poor people in my district, and I'm hearing from them that though they have this coverage or they have Medicaid, they're not able to find a doctor. And I'm hearing from the doctors who are saying they're actually losing money in taking care of these people the way we've set up these programs, which obviously does not work.
We spoke yesterday with Kathleen Sebelius, the former Health and Human Services Secretary, and asked her about the fact that this plan calls for an increase in health savings accounts, which she says are great in theory, but many people don't have the extra money to put into health savings accounts. Are you concerned about that at all?
No, I'm not. I think the more we make those available to people and take the unwarranted restrictions that were put on them under Obamacare, I think more people will not only have them, they'll use them and find them to be very beneficial. Look, people's deductibles and copays have gone up dramatically. And at least we could help people with some of those copays and deductibles by giving them an account that they can put money into and draw out of and not have to pay taxes on it.
But people would still have to have the money to put into those accounts.
Well, and that's why we have the refundable tax credit option that's in this program, which I think will help a lot of people. People will have money, and if they want to put them in these accounts, they can. If they want to use some other vehicle to do it, they can do that too. The hallmark of what we've got here is that we're taking mandates off of people and off of providers. We trust the American people to make the right choices for themselves and not have some big government bureaucracy tell them what they can and can't do.
Are you concerned that the AARP, the American Medical Association, and the American Hospital Association have come out against this plan?
Those are very important organizations. We need to listen to them, as I do all the time. But at the end of the day, we have to take into account all of the different concerns that we all have here and make sure that we come up with a plan that makes sense for everybody. What we've done here is reach an appropriate balance that takes care of all the concerns in the best way possible going forward. And as we implement this problem going forward, we should work with all those organizations you just named.
I want to ask you about one more thing, and that's the politics of this. Senator Tom Cotton, Republican of Arkansas, tweeted today, "House health care bill can't pass Senate without major changes. To my friends in House, pause, start over, get it right. don't get it fast. Do you think that you're going to have some problems getting this not just through the House but through the Senate, even with Republicans in charge?
Well, I don't speak for the Senate. We've had enough senators trying to tell the House members what to do, and I'm certainly not going to tell the Senate what to do. I trust when we pass a bill over here that Trump will go over there with Senate Republicans and Senate Democrats and explain to them in clear and precise terms why it's important to them to pass this bill.
That's Congressman Bradley Byrne, a Republican from Alabama. Congressman, thanks so much.
It's great to be with you.
Well, another Republican member of Alabama's congressional delegation joins us now with a different perspective. Mo Brooks is a member of the House Freedom Caucus. He represents Alabama's 5th District in northern Alabama and joins us by Skype. And Congressman Brooks, if your fellow Congressman Byrne is in favor of the bill with some tinkering, you and other members of your caucus have called this bill Republican welfare, Obamacare light, and a lump of coal. Pretty straightforward. Why are you so strongly opposed to the Republican plan?
Well, first and foremost is you have to look at our country's finances. Just in January, a month and a half ago, we were warned by the Congressional Budget Office that America's current financial path is unsustainable, quote unquote. Unsustainable in accounting language means that you're headed for insolvency and bankruptcy. And for us to even consider imposing yet another huge welfare program, entitlement program, on top of all those others that are already driving us into insolvency and bankruptcy is the height of financial irresponsibility.
Well, let's explain, because under Obamacare, there was a subsidy. The Republican plan is offering a tax credit, but to you and others, that feels like the same thing?
Neither plan, Obamacare or the Republican welfare plan, are fully paid for with tax revenue. Both rely on deficit spending to come up with the money, to give away the money. And this deficit spending is going to bankrupt the United States of America. I'm not going to be for it.
Well, you also remind us that there actually hasn't been an accounting of this plan. The Congressional Budget Office has not, there are no figures on it. But take up Medicaid for just a second. More than half of the 20 million Americans who are insured under Obamacare, 10 million of those people got that insurance through the Medicaid expansion. Now, we just heard Representative Byrne say the Medicaid expansion was too generous. To remind people in states that took it, not Alabama, it expanded from the very poor to individuals making about $16,000 a year and families of four making up about $33,000. Now, to a lot of people, that doesn't sound overly generous. Are you concerned if those people are suddenly pulled out of the Medicaid expansion, 10 million, you're going to have just as much cost in trips to the emergency room in other ways?
Maybe I'm not breaking through the fog. If the United States of America goes belly up, goes into insolvency and bankruptcy, there will be no money for Medicaid, and there will be no money for those emergency room visits.
Look, premiums did go up in your state, an average of 36%. Obamacare subsidies offset most of those rate hikes for 90% of the people in your state. I hear you loud and clear that you're worried about a deficit. There are a lot of economists who say, you know, deficits are not necessarily a bad thing.
If there are any economists out there that are legitimate economists who think that deficit and debt is harmless, they need to go look at Venezuela right now, where they've had a huge weight loss program. It's caused by not having enough food to put on the table for people to eat.
Listen, your caucus will have to hold together to oppose this bill. Otherwise, you know, you won't keep it from passing. Your Freedom Caucus is very important in this moment. Is the caucus going to hold together?
I can't answer that. All I can say is where I stand. In my judgment, there ought to be a complete repeal of Obamacare. We ought to implement free market things that we can do, like interstate competition for health insurance. And then we ought to turn it over to the states. And those states who want Obamacare, California, New York, they can pass it as long as they can pay for it.
Last question. Len Nichols, who's a health policy professor at George Mason, says the very population that voted for Trump, working class, without employer insurance, is going to end up the worse off through this Republican plan. You'd rather have no plan. I understand that. But do you worry about political blowback from your constituents if there isn't a plan to replace Obamacare, which is what they demanded in their vote?
Okay, let's be clear. If you repeal Obamacare, there is a replacement. That replacement is the best health care system in the world that we had in 2009 that cost a whole lot less. than what people are being forced to pay now in premiums and in taxes. So that is a de facto replacement if you repeal Obamacare. But my constituents, they elected me to study these types of issues and to try to understand these issues better than they do so that I can be in a better position to act on their behalf. And if I save the United States of America from a debilitating insolvency and bankruptcy that looms on our horizon, the people of my district will be most pleased.
Well, look, of course, back in 2009, people with pre-existing conditions could not get covered. So this debate is going to go on. Alabama Congressman Mo Brooks, a member of the Freedom Caucus, staunchly against the new Republican replacement health care plan. Congressman Brooks, thanks so much for talking to us.
My pleasure. Have a good one.
The Secretary of Homeland Security said this week that he's seen an unprecedented decline in the number of illegal border crossings into the U.S. in recent months. Secretary John Kelly called the trend encouraging and says it coincides with President Trump's recent executive orders calling for tougher enforcement of U.S. immigration laws. But that tougher enforcement has led to a number of deportations that have alarmed immigrants and activists, including the case of Guadalupe Garcia de Rios, a mother of two who's been living in Arizona for 21 years since she was 14. Back in 2008, she was arrested for using a fake Social Security number to work, and ever since then, she's been checking in regularly with immigration officials. But last month, when she went in for her check-in, she was arrested and deported to her native Mexico. Her lawyer, Ray Ibarra Maldonado, joins us by Skype from Phoenix. And Ray, do you know why, after all this time, she was arrested and detained and deported?
The real reason why she was detained and deported was because of the new executive orders from President Trump. It makes clear that anybody with a conviction, anybody they think that has even done a criminal act before, is now a priority for deportation. So in the past, she's been able to walk into that ICE office and walk out. But because of these new executive orders, she was unable to, and she was sent back to Mexico.
Well, and I'm sure there are many people who would argue that this was just, that she was in the country illegally. She pleaded guilty to a crime. She should have been deported a long time ago. Why should she get to stay?
Oh, trust me, I've had more than a fair share of those comments, people saying that. But let's look at what her real crime was. Her real crime was working to support herself, to feed her kids, to try to provide her kids with a better life than what she had growing up. Morally, I see absolutely nothing wrong with what she did. And if we're going to deport someone that's been here for 20 years, has U.S. citizen kids, is just trying to make a life for themselves and their family, you know, to me, that is the injustice. The fact that we criminalize immigrants who are simply trying to work, support themselves and their families.
Did she get a hearing before she was deported?
She did. You know, she went through the process. The important thing to remember here is these raids in which she was arrested occurred under Sheriff Joe Arpaio's reign of terror here in Arizona, where he racially profiled people. That's been, you know, found from a federal judge that he's engaged in racial profiling. He's absolutely ignored orders from this federal judge. As a result of that, she has a felony conviction. She had her immigration court hearing, and the judge there gave her voluntary departure. She didn't leave, and eventually that turned into a removal order.
And she has been sent to Nogales, Mexico. Have you heard from her? How's she doing down there?
Yeah, I've talked to her since then, talked to the family since then. She's since gone back where she was born, a little bit down south more. It's tough. You know, it's a really tight family. They're very religious people. And to be separated after so many years of being together, it's painful for the entire family. With that said, they're incredibly strong, and they're looking forward to a fight, not only to bring her back, but to stop other people's families from being separated.
Do they have any recourse at this point? Do you have any recourse at this point to get this order reversed?
It's all Hail Mary passes from here out, but we're not going to stop until every avenue has been exhausted. You know, we're going to take another look at her criminal conviction, take a look at the possibility of reopening her immigration case. It's not going to be an easy route, but we're not going to stop until we've tried every avenue possible.
In general, what would your advice be to people who are in this country illegally right now, given the changes that you're seeing in how deportation orders are being carried out?
You know, number one, it's look for a way to adjust your status. A lot of people don't know about U visas. A lot of people don't know about certain waivers. So if there's something that can be done through the legal system, definitely do everything you can to make that happen. Number two, if there's nothing you can do, if you've already tried that route, it's very important that you don't give more information to agents than necessary. What we always tell people is exercise your right to remain silent. If you're asked any questions, you know, give whatever you have to give under your state laws as far as name and date of birth, but don't answer questions about your immigration status, country of origin. You know, make the government do its job and prove that you're removable and ask for that attorney as soon as you can.
That's attorney Ray Ibarra Maldonado. His client, Guadalupe Garcia de Rios, was arrested and deported to Mexico last month after living in the U.S. illegally for more than 20 years. Her husband is still here, and so are her two U.S.-born children. Ray, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And that case is just one of many. And joining us now with the big picture is Alan Gomez, who covers immigration in Latin America for USA Today. Alan, how much has the atmosphere changed for people who are here illegally under the Trump administration?
That is very difficult to put into words. I mean, there were periods during the Obama administration where he was called the deporter in chief. But for the most part, if you're an undocumented immigrant living in the country, your odds of getting picked up and deported were pretty low. And so now what we've seen is that everything that Trump promised on the campaign trail about going after the undocumented, about whittling down that 11 million, it's absolutely happening. And so that's why you're seeing folks from all walks of life in that undocumented immigrant population absolutely terrified that they're going to be next.
So when Trump said that his first priority is to go after people who've committed serious crimes, is that what's happening? Or is it really anybody who is here in this country illegally is at risk now?
And that's where things have changed. I looked at some raids under Obama and the first one under Trump. Last year, about 90% of the people that were picked up in immigration raids had a criminal conviction. And the first raids conducted under President Trump, that number fell down to 74%. Mm. And ICE made clear that they are picking up anybody else along the way that they encounter. So picture they go in to target somebody who's a convicted murderer. If there's other people in the apartment, under Obama, those people wouldn't have been touched. Under President Trump, they're getting picked up as well.
There was one group that was notably left out of these increased enforcement orders, the so-called Dreamers, people who were brought here illegally as children who qualify for DACA or deferred action for childhood arrivals. But we've heard now of at least two Dreamers who have been arrested so far, Daniela Vargas and Daniel Ramirez Medina. What can you tell us about them and why they were arrested?
Right now, DACA still stands. When the president issued his executive order on January 25th, outlining his new deportation priorities, it made very clear that DACA remains and that their deportation protections will be honored. But right, we're hearing cases like Vargas and Ramirez of people getting picked up. And so in Medina's case, ICE says that he had admitted gang affiliations. And so that's why they picked him up. Mm. But he's qualified for DACA twice. And so the question is how they're interpreting DACA. Whatever history he had with gangs, was that on the books before, but the Obama administration decided, hey, you know what, he's past that, he's all good, and now President Trump's administration is looking at that and saying, well, gang ties, let's get him out. We're not sure what's going on there. The other case with Vargas, again, she is an Argentinian, 22 years old, arrested just a few minutes after she spoke at an immigration protest. And in that case, we have absolutely no idea why she was picked up.
I want to listen to something that Homeland Security Secretary Kelly said that shocked a lot of people. He says the administration is now considering separating parents and children who cross the U.S.-Mexico border illegally. Here he is talking to CNN's Wolf Blitzer.
Yes, I am considering, in order to deter more movement along this terribly dangerous network, I am considering exactly that. They will be well cared for as we deal with their parents.
Have we ever seen anything like that before, that the government would be separating women and children who are crossing illegally?
Not so overtly, but we have seen it in practice in a way. I mean, parents have been deported from this country for a long time, leaving their children behind. There was a practice years ago that has now become quite common again of parents kind of writing these living wills, these plans of what's going to happen to their children, who gets them if they get deported. This is obviously more extreme, but about this time last year, the Obama administration conducted a raid specifically targeting women and children from Central America who'd arrived in the U.S. in the previous year or two. And that kind of shows how difficult it is to sort of send this message of deterrence to these Central American mothers and children. You know, on the one hand, you have just overwhelming sympathy for what they're going through, for the conditions that they're leaving. I've been to Guatemala and Honduras, and I've seen firsthand just how omnipresent that gang threat is, that threat of violence is down there. But on the other hand, they're coming by the tens of thousands. And so trying to figure out a way to really send a clear message of deterrence back to the home countries is obviously very difficult and leading to extreme measures like this.
Alan, this has been such a tricky political issue for so long. People have very intense passions on both sides of this issue of illegal immigration. What's been the reaction to all of these stories that we've been hearing about people who in the past maybe wouldn't have been deported, now being deported?
Well, and I think, like with so many other things going on right now, it depends on who you ask. I mean, if you ask that section of the country that is just completely enamored with what President Trump is doing, they're saying, hey, he's just fulfilling his campaign promise. He wasn't shy about it. This is what he started his campaign on. So for a lot of people in this country, they see everything that he's doing as a fulfillment of everything that he promised he would do. Obviously, if you talk to those families and if you talk to immigration advocacy groups and if you talk to people who are just general Trump critics, they see this as just a terrorizing, horrible event that just violates possibly our laws and at the very least our morals. You know,
but we're
the
not seeing big protests in the streets of Miami or Los Angeles yet.
Yet. And I think that's because it's a case here, a case there. It, you know, it makes it hard to sort of reach that critical mass to see the kind of protests that, you know, we saw, like, for example, back in 2006 is the last time we really saw massive immigration protests in this country. But I can tell you, the more of these kind of cases, the more faces of 22 and 23-year-olds, the more cases of grandmothers getting deported for no other reason than they lied about their identity when they tried to get a job, as these accumulate, I think you're going to start seeing a little bit more of that.
That's Alan Gomez, who covers immigration in Latin America for USA Today. Alan, thanks as always.
Jeremy, thank you so much.
Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson. And you know, a lot of people don't know that podcasts exist. They've never listened to one. At Here and Now, we want to change that. So all this month, we're inviting listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. You can do it in real life or on social media, and make sure you let us know what you're recommending. Tell us using the hashtag tripod, that is hashtag TRYPOD. And thanks.
And there's more fallout today from the massive WikiLeaks dump of apparent CIA documents earlier this week. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange said on Facebook Live that his organization will work with tech companies to fix security flaws the spy agency was apparently exploiting.
I want to announce today that after hearing these calls from some of the manufacturers, we have decided to work with them to give them some exclusive access to the additional technical details we have so that fixes can be developed and pushed out so people can be secured.
Well, NPR reporter Camila Domonoske has been reporting on this. And Camila, this was the first time Assange has spoken publicly since the documents were made public Tuesday. What does he mean? Is he going to give tech companies, let's say, code that was redacted from the docs? Tell us more.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So what we learned from this press conference was more about what WikiLeaks is planning to do next. They originally left the actual code for these programs out of the document dump. They said it was too dangerous to release it in its entirety, and they were trying to figure out what to do. So now, apparently, they've figured it out. What they plan on doing is sharing portions of that with the tech companies who make the devices that these tools would be used against so that the companies can build defenses against them. And once those are in place, WikiLeaks says that they'll then release the code once it no longer does anything publicly online.
Okay, well, people might think that all of that is still dangerous, but Assange took a shot today at the CIA. Tell us more.
Yeah, they had a bit of a back and forth. So Assange and WikiLeaks say that the CIA lost control of its entire set of hacking tools. That's their claim as to how they got this information. And today, Assange called it a historic act of devastating incompetence on the part of the CIA to have let that happen at all. The CIA has not commented on the authenticity of these documents, but they did comment to respond to Assange's press conference. And the CIA's official statement was that Julian Assange is not exactly a bastion of truth and integrity.
Ouch.
So they were really taking shots at each other.
Well,
there.
As the CIA also sent out this statement yesterday, not mentioning documents, but saying their mission is to aggressively collect foreign intelligence overseas and that they are legally prohibited from conducting electronic surveillance. Look, today Reuters was reporting that both Germany and China are scolding the U.S. for spying and looking to into possible hacking because of these documents. We think of 2013's Edward Snowden leaks of confidential NSA documents. You say this is different.
Yeah, there's a couple of reasons why there are significant differences between the two leaks. One is, as you just referenced, the question of where this spying is being done. If it's being done abroad, if it's being done against people who are not U.S. citizens, that is part of the CIA's mandate. If it's being used against Americans, that's a very different scenario. The NSA leaks, you might remember, there was a massive shock that there was collection of millions of Americans' phone data. Nothing in the documents released so far by WikiLeaks suggests that these tools have been used against Americans in the same way. Another difference is just the difference between mass surveillance on a massive scale like the NSA leaks revealed and really targeted tools like the CIA was using against one phone at a time.
Right. Or one TV.
NPR's
Camila Domonoske. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
When President Trump talks about building a wall along the 2,000-mile U.S.-Mexico border, he often points to Israel for proof that walls can keep people out.
Do walls work? Just ask Israel. They work.
But do they? This week, we're looking at the president's plans to build a wall along our southern border with our colleagues at the public radio show Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. Their reporter, Emily Harris, spent 3 years reporting from Israel for NPR. She's back in the States now, but has teamed up with producer Mark Baker, who is on the ground in Israel, for an up-close look at that country's border walls.
Israel's best-known wall is part of about 300 miles of barrier that twists between Israel and the West Bank. It's a combination barrier. About 10% is concrete wall, and about 90% is high-tech wire mesh fence. It often cuts deep into land that Palestinians claim for a future country of their own. Our producer Mark met up with a former Israeli army colonel, Danny Tirza. They drove to a spot where the tall concrete wall switches to a fence that's loaded with electronic sensors.
We are just in the place that the fence is kissing the wall.
Some people call Danny the father of this barrier. He decided where it goes. He figured out where to put the fences and where to build the walls.
In some places, the Palestinians were shooting from their areas toward a traffic that runs inside Israel. So I had to construct concrete walls to protect the traffic from the snipers.
Where this barrier is, wall, it is big. That's one of the things President Trump says he wants. Most stretches of wall in Israel's West Bank barrier are nearly 30 feet tall. Danny talks in meters. That's 9 meters high.
Some people says to me, can you make it some shorter? Well, really, at first I tried to construct only 6 meters high. But 6 meters, if you climb it, some people can jump. 9 meters, nobody jumps.
They have to climb down somehow, which Danny says gives soldiers time to show up. Of course, Danny didn't climb the wall when he was talking with us, but within 5 minutes, Israeli soldiers showed up anyway.
1 minute, the soldiers here, they just want us to see. Okay, the soldiers are very curious about what we're doing here.
He says it's good they're curious because a fence or a wall only works with a lot of human backup. Armed Israeli security forces work both sides of the West Bank barrier. Danny says that's why it's successful, even in places it's not fully built.
We have soldiers and border police in these places, so therefore you cannot cross today from the West Bank to Israel unless you cross a checkpoint.
Except you can cross without passing a checkpoint.
It's an early start.
Yeah.
Before dawn recently, Mark and his interpreter headed to the Palestinian village of Wadi Fukin. It's in the West Bank. It's tucked below an Israeli settlement and almost next to the official boundary line with Israel. This is one spot where the barrier has not been built.
We're on the hillside now. And we're heading down into the valley.
The village sits in a narrow valley that's surrounded by rocky, rounded hills. It's a 20-minute climb through fields and forests to enter Israel. There's no border guards along the way, no checkpoint. And every workday, Palestinian laborers come from all over the West Bank to take that walk. Mark walked with them.
Okay. We've come to the place where there are about 15 men and four or five vans dropping them off. Maybe 20 men. And they're all making their way up through a rough hill with some grass and rocks and olive trees. And we can actually see people coming from over hills in the distance, making their way in our direction up towards the border. And do the police ever come along here?
Sometimes.
Is this area famous then as a place to cross?
Yeah, it's like everyone knows that. So basically, the question was like, you've been doing this for years, and they never knew that you're doing this. He says, no, they know this, and they want us to get in to work and to do, you know, the building stuff and construction. But they have to make it hard for us to get inside.
That's one way you can sneak from the West Bank into Israel. Other Palestinians have used ladders to scale the wall and ropes to slide down, or they've clipped the fence and snuck through the hole. Like the U.S. depends on Mexican workers, Israel needs Palestinians to do jobs like construction and restaurant work. And even though there are still ways over, around, and through, most Israelis say the West Bank barrier has helped lower the number of Palestinian terrorist attacks done inside Israel. A tougher Israeli barrier to cross runs 150 miles along Israel's desert border with Egypt. Before a high-tech fence covered the whole thing, tens of thousands of people entered Israel there without permission. Many of them had left wars in Eritrea and Sudan.
When Israel constructed the Egyptian border, basically it solved our problem.
This is Sar Kursh. He heads the Israeli company Magal S3, which makes high-tech border barriers. The technology includes sensors that are set off by a hand touching a fence and microwaves that pick up movement nearby. He built the Israeli-Egyptian border fence.
It took us 2 years to complete the project, and then the number of illegal immigrants dropped dramatically from 2,000 on average per month to less than 10 per month.
There are other factors, like detention inside Israel, that might play a role here. But these are the kind of numbers that President Trump is looking for. He regularly praises Israel's walls as 99.9% successful. But a few years after this fence along Israel's border with Egypt was finished, the number of people who managed to cross it began to creep up again. So Israel kept building. More sensors went in. And Israel just finished raising 10 miles of this fence from 16 to 26 feet high. For Here and Now, I'm Emily Harris.
Well, people are cleaning up in the Midwest today after high winds whipped through several Great Lakes states. There were gusts of more than 60 miles per hour in some places. The high winds turned deadly in Detroit. They fanned a fire that killed 5 people. Roofs were blown off schools in Michigan. A commuter jet carrying the Michigan basketball team to the Big Ten tournament was pushed off the runway during takeoff. No one injured, and the team's flight to Washington was delayed until this morning. There were problems in other states as well. In Ohio, a truck rolled over on a bridge when it was hit by a wind gust. Commuter trains were forced to stop in East Chicago, Indiana, when high-voltage power lines were blown down and fell on the tracks. Across the region, hundreds of thousands lost power, and crews are still working today to restore service to some. Jeff Masters is a meteorologist at Weather Underground. He told Michigan Radio he's never seen high winds like this in more than 30 years as a forecaster.
Sustained winds of 40 miles per hour or greater at multiple stations. I've seen gusts as high as 65 miles per hour. Over on the west side of the state, they've got it the worst. Grand Rapids, sustained winds of 47 miles per hour. That's more than tropical storm force. It's going to cause a lot of damage when you have sustained winds for multiple hours like that. And the number of power outages we're seeing, I mean, that's bad ice storm level power outages, 350,000 customers. We haven't seen that level of power loss in a number of years.
The high winds and damage extended into western New York, knocking out power across a region stretching from the state's southwestern corner through the Buffalo area to Lake Ontario's southern shoreline. The Rochester area, especially hard hit, with fallen trees and utility poles blocking roads and knocking out power. The National Weather Service says a wind gust of 81 miles per hour was recorded at the Rochester Airport. The tax return deadline this year is April 18th. That's a Tuesday, and some have already started filing. But for those who haven't, what's the best way to do that? Use a tax professional or software like TurboTax? Dennis Ventry is a professor of tax law at the University of California, Davis, and a member of the Internal Revenue Service Advisory Council. Dennis, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And of the 152 million tax returns received by the IRS last year, 35% were self-prepared online, 52% were filed by tax professionals. Which one is better? Which makes more sense?
Well, it totally depends on your particular situation. The kind of questions you want to be asking there are some are personal, some have to do with your income. So if for some reason you would want to sit down across the table from a tax professional, just look that person in the eye, have an ongoing relationship with that person throughout the tax year, which is usually how it works. If things go really bad, you can sue them a little bit easier. And the on the flip side of that, and really driving the tax professional versus tax prep software, a very large component should have to do with the taxpayer's income. And so if you have very, call them simple returns or unsophisticated returns where most of your income or all of your income comes from wages, if you don't have capital gains or royalties or things like that, then a tax prep software, either fee-based or free, would be the way to go. And then if you are, in fact, thinking about the software route, there's even more fine-grained considerations. The free-based software is really only available to a certain sector of taxpayers, but not to all taxpayers.
Now, one of the things that I think people, when they're trying to decide whether to do their taxes themselves or send them off to a tax professional, one of the things that they think about is whether the tax professional is going to be smarter at getting them all kinds of deductions and things like that. Is that true? Does the tax software not make it clear enough to most people of what they can actually deduct?
Well, for the vast majority of taxpayers, I mean, first of all, as a threshold matter, only 30% of taxpayers take itemized deductions. The other 70% of taxpayers, it's actually closer to 71%, take the standard deduction. So in terms of, you know, having like finagling the system or having somebody who knows a back door that the software can't identify, that's really not a legitimate reason to go the tax professional route. There are other reasons to go the tax professional route, but that's not one of them.
How often do people overpay, though, when they use a tax professional to get their taxes filed?
It depends. I think more than anything, it has to do with the sophistication of your return. If you have a return that is, let's say, under $60,000 of adjusted gross income, you don't itemize, or you might itemize a little bit. You don't have a whole, you haven't sold a home, or you don't have capital gains. If that's the case, then, I mean, I've maintained for a long time that there's no reason why those folks should pay a dime for filing their taxes, whether it's to a software provider or to a tax professional, because those returns, the information on those returns, the government has the vast majority of that information in the form of your W-2, your third-party reporting, what you told the government the prior year, things like that, where you would only need to provide some additional information most of the time, such as if your tax filing status has changed, if you've gotten married, divorced, if you have another child, if you change jobs. In my state of California, we have a program called CalFile that's been around now for about 10 years, and it's for filing taxpayers' state income tax returns. And it's an online, free electronic filing software. The income thresholds are actually really high. It's $180,000 roughly for a single taxpayer, double that for a married couple. You can itemize. You can claim the standard deduction. You can have interest and dividend income, all sorts of things. It doesn't include all taxpayers, but we've had it in California now for close to 10 years, and it's worked incredibly well.
So when you hear politicians say that we're going to simplify the tax code and everybody's going to fill out a note card or whatever, is that something that you think is ever going to actually happen, or do you think we're too far down this road?
No, that will never happen. but that's not going to happen for a different reason. That's not necessarily going to be Congress saying that the feds couldn't get in the business of preparing returns, assisting taxpayers with preparing their returns. But more to your point, for instance, the last postcard return or whatever they're calling it these days that I saw only had two itemized deductions left on it out of about 225 special dispensations that total about $1.4 trillion. A year in lost tax revenue. The only two that would remain would be the home mortgage interest deduction and the charitable contribution deduction. That means you'd have to take out more than 200 of those tax expenditure items, each of which has constituencies that benefit from it and that would fight tooth and nail before those got taken out of the code.
That's Dennis Ventry, a professor of law at the University of California, Davis, and also a member of the Internal Revenue Service Advisory Council. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
And while we're thinking about the tax deadline in April, a reminder that this weekend is the start of daylight saving time, Sunday, 2 a.m.
Boo.
Spring forward.
Yeah, but darker in the morning. Okay.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.